This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow marks the 250th anniversary of the birth of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Today we celebrate with acclaimed concert pianist and Mozart scholar Robert Levin. We'll listen at piano side as he plays from some of the Mozart works that have lifted audiences out of their seats for 2.5 centuries. And we'll look at the man and mind behind the music, the child prodigy who was paraded across Europe at age 7, the musical genius whose astounding art soared above a tumultuous life. This hour, On Point, listening to Mozart at 250. Joining me now at the piano is Robert Levin. He's a celebrated concert pianist who's performed throughout Europe and the United States. He's also a professor of music at Harvard University and an acclaimed Mozart scholar. He's completed unfinished Mozart compositions, including Mozart's Requiem, and he's at the grand piano keyboard with us now. Robert Levin, thanks so much for sitting down with us.
It's such a pleasure to be here with you, Tom.
We're here to celebrate and to investigate this man, this music. You are have been soaked in it for a long time. Before we even look at the life, how does Mozart stand apart? What distinguishes him?
He seems to be someone who, more than any other composer of any age, excelled in every kind of musical composition that was practiced by anybody. That is, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about sacred music, about operas, about instrumental music, whether we're talking about piano music or string quartets or symphonies, whether we're talking about music for wind ensemble, whether we're talking about entertainment music, lighthearted things, or whether we're talking about deep, serious kinds of enterprises, whether we're talking about flashy things or meditative things. Mozart wrote operas in German. He wrote operas in Italian. He wrote songs in both German and Italian and French to boot. He spoke fluent French, fluent Italian, fluent German, obviously, not so fluent English, but he was probably one of the first total Europeans. And I was watching a Mozart documentary a few days ago when I was in Germany, and I heard Daniel Barenboim say that if Mozart were alive today, he'd probably live in Brussels.
It would have to be the center of it all. Robert Levin, we've got this keyboard at your fingertips, and we want to have it in our ears as we think about, as we dive into the music of Mozart. When you turn to those keys, and with Mozart on your mind, what comes to you?
Well, what comes out to me is the message that Mozart sends, obviously almost by osmosis, to very, very little children as well as grown-ups. It's one of these peculiar facts that little kids who are talented at music start to write music in the style of Mozart, not anybody else. They don't write pieces in the style of Bach or Brahms or Stravinsky.
This is child composers. It comes to them as if... You know,
4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds who start to dabble in music. The question is, why do they do that? And it's because one can think of music history as a kind of way of looking through the viewfinder of a single-lens reflex camera.
Yes.
And as composers try to represent, to capture the essence of the social relationships and the emotions of their day, they rotate the barrel of that lens and focus it in various ways.
Okay.
So the music becomes more and more well-defined, and at Mozart's moment in the sun, it reaches a maximum of clarity, and that can be shown very, very clearly why kids respond to this, because what Mozart does is he asks you a question and he gives you an answer, and the balance of the question and the balance of the answer are so clear that everybody listening in the room seems to understand it. He plays the game, in other words, of getting you involved by making you project. Here's the beginning of one of his piano sonatas. Thank you.
so on. Now,
there's
you
the
can
question.
Say, all right, you know, here all of this is very fine and good, but what am I listening to? So let's take it apart and start to analyze how we react to it. I start the piece and I go... So I've got a trumpet fanfare.
You
think,
my
attention. Isn't that great?
Yes,
you know,
you're
fine,
calling
exactly.
out to us.
I want you to respond to that. And I said, what's the next thing that's going to happen? Well, you don't know. You could say, he'll do the same thing. He'll answer this.
Right back down the ladder.
Yes, which would not be very clever, would
well,
it?
Well, Mozart.
You know, no. I mean, because Mozart is always far behind what anyone else could imagine.
Right?
He could go this way. So something happens, but all of that doesn't seem very interesting to him. He decides that this ear-catching fanfare is going to be answered with something that you wouldn't expect. A cute little girl in crinolines dancing and curtsying instead of the trumpets blasting as the king walks in.
Yes.
So you think, well, gee whiz, all right. Now what happens next? Well, you see, he's asked the question by having the fanfare
and
the cute little girl.
Yes.
So he's asked the question. You think, now what's next going to happen? You think, I think he's going to answer the question by having the fanfare and the little girl.
Play in,
you
with,
see?
With each other.
So, yeah, exactly. Because you had half.
Yeah, we're there.
And the other half. So he'll probably do the same thing. So you think...
Just mix it up a little bit, but...
Now, that would be fine. That answers the question. Only he's Mozart. And he's not just good. He's great. And he's not just great. He's off the charts. So the answer...
Right,
you see, the imagination is so restless, he starts in the wrong key after the right one. You think, what's he going to do then? Well, he could have gone. But instead, the little girl shakes her head. The curls, you know, shake in front of us. She smiles, and we think, this guy is more than good. This guy has got it. Meanwhile, you say to yourself, I had a fanfare. Yeah. I had a curtsying girl asking a question. It was answered by a fanfare and a curtsying girl with an answer. Now, what do I expect? I expect all of that again. So this, then, you see, so you start to add 2 plus 2 is 4, 4 plus 4 is 8, 8 plus 8 equals 16.
Fantastic.
And he draws you into projecting what's going to happen next. It's watching the 3 walnut shells and the pea. You know, do you know where the pea is going to be?
Amadeus, 1756 to 1791, not a long life, but such an incredible legacy that he's left us. Give us just a little bit of historical context. What was the world, the musical world, that Mozart was born into?
Mozart was born into the Baroque world, a world that Johann Sebastian Bach had just left in 1750. Telemann was still alive when Mozart was born. Handel, all of these great Baroque people, and Mozart's father, Leopold, who was the only one who really gave him formal musical training, or indeed schooling of any kind. You know, he never went to school for a single day and learned all those languages and dabbled in number theory and was interested in
how could
all
he?
Of this
they
stuff.
Were parading him all around they Europe were from age seven.
But, you know, I mean, he learned all of this stuff from his dad, and his dad was born in 1714, so he was brought up as a Baroque musician. So we have these old traditions of serious polyphony of Bach, which are giving way to a more gallant, more elegant kind of style. You have the middle class coming up wanting entertainment.
Yes.
Concerts in the Vauxhall Gardens of London, where Johann Christian Bach, who helps Mozart and is an influence on him, and Carl Friedrich Abel, two expatriate Germans, are playing light classics, so to speak.
Come on in,
for the new
yourselves.
Rich people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
isn't life wonderful?
Sounds like it could be Mozart, but it's actually Johann Christian Bach.
Mm-hmm.
Gives Mozart some ideas about what he can do. And this lighter, more elegant music gets rid of this more rigorous stuff. And it's Mozart is born at the cusp of that change. And then, of course, his father discovers his talents. He starts to compose when he's 5. And as soon as possible, the father collects some money through some supporters in Salzburg who help finance the trip. And off they go. They go through Munich. They go to Paris. They go to London. They go to The Hague. They go to Burgundy. And the brother and his sister, the older Maria Anna, Nannerl, are paraded around playing, you know, with a tablecloth over the keys so that they can't see what they're doing to show that they can. Mozart making up music on the spot.
Parlor tricks, parlor miracles. And when the Boy Wonder is being paraded, what's he playing then?
What he's playing is, in fact, some pieces of his own composition. He's sketching with pencil restlessly. He's publishing pieces already. You can still see the first edition of his sonatas for keyboard with an accompaniment of a violin composed by J.G. Wolfgang Mozart, age 7. You know, in the frontispiece. I mean, it's quite amazing. And then the next opus, age 9, and parading, of course, for the crowned heads of Europe, slipping on the sheer marble of the Palace of Versailles, being picked up by Marie Antoinette, thanking her and saying that someday he would come back and marry her. Well, Mozart might have had a cruel fate, but if he had married Marie Antoinette, it might have been worse.
It would have been more cruel. And last month, Der Spiegel, the German magazine, their cover is Das himmlische Kind, the heavenly child, 250 years later, always something of the child in Mozart, or at least for a very long time, that play. Is there, or is that only early in his life?
No, it's not early in his life. One of the extraordinary things about certain composers, Mozart, Schubert, at times Mahler, is their ability to understand the nostalgic sense of the simplicity of being young, of simple emotions, of simple desires. And Mozart is able, to the very day he dies, to write folk-like music like Papageno. You listen to it and you all feel that, oh my God, how could anybody have composed that? That must have been around forever. So by remembering the simplicity of a child when he experiences complex emotions, of course, they're so much more powerful. If you're a hero like Wagner all of the time, you're living in a super high scale. And one needs sometimes to be reminded of being a kid.
That's beautiful. There's so much more we want to hear. We are celebrating the 250th birthday of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. It is tomorrow. We're with Robert Levin, concert pianist, Mozart scholar, professor of music at Harvard University. We'll go out listening to the second movement of Mozart's Symphony No. 40. We'll be back with much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy birthday, Mozart. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are celebrating Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart on the eve of the 250th anniversary of his birth with concert pianist and Mozart scholar Robert Levin at the grand piano keyboard here, coming in with Mozart's Horn Concerto in D with Neville Mariner conducting the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. Let's listen. Robert Levin, you have us placed with him being paraded around Europe as a very, very young boy. How old was Mozart when that world began to recognize him, not just as a child prodigy, as a fantastic novelty, but as a composer of weight, of substance?
Oh, it took quite a long time. After all, when he went to Italy in his teens and started to write operas on commission, not just pieces that he was being encouraged to write by his father. He started to write operas when he was 12, hard to believe. But he was writing very well-shaped, very professional operas in Italy. But there were struggles against them. They said, who is this kid from Germany? And what is he doing there? Because Salzburg was actually considered part of Germany in those days, not part of Austria. Mm-hmm. And It took until Mozart was in his 20s for him to hit his stride as a composer heard by people all around Europe, although he was certainly writing masterpieces in his late teens, like the violin concertos, for instance, in the 29th Symphony. But one has to remember that Mozart's major source of fame was what he did at the piano. He was actually first and foremost a concert pianist of dazzling virtuosity, and even more than that, if one wishes, an improviser who could just shake music out of his sleeves and play a fantasy or a set of variations on a popular tune of the day without thinking for a second. And his music, of course, was recognized for a while by a fickle Viennese public as being quite special. But then people started to complain that it was too complicated, it was too difficult to understand, it was too thickly scored, it was too rich. Well, indeed, indeed. And in fact, if you read people's reactions in those days, you realize that Mozart, who's thought of now as the epitome of taste and elegance and refinement, was thought of then as being uncomfortably intense.
Uncomfortably intense, and yet we look back on him and it's so pleasant. It's not the intensity, it's how pleasant this
is. Well, I think one of the reasons that it sounds so pleasant is that a lot of our performers have turned themselves into purveyors of hot fudge, and that they don't always look behind the facade, which can be extremely elegant, and they don't see some of the tumult underneath it.
And you mean the performers of Mozart?
I mean the performers today of the music of Mozart.
You mean we're getting sweetened up sugar versions?
I think so. I think so to a large extent. And they're very pleasant, but they don't scratch the surface, whether it's the symphonies or the piano concertos or sonatas. At least in the operas, there's enough dramatic going on that people know what to do. But if you take the case of Mozart going to Paris in 1778, with his mother, his father no longer had the right to leave Salzburg. There he is trying to get a job. He doesn't get a job, and his mother falls sick and suddenly dies. And there she is lying dead in the other room, and Mozart is trying to figure out what is he going to tell his father?
Yes.
How is he going to go on from here? His life is really in ruins. He has no excuses. There's nothing he can do. And he sits down and he writes. He's not writing. You know, and it's like Edgar Allan Poe. The music becomes very pleasant.
But the mother's corpse is in the next room.
Yes, and it's like the Telltale Heart, where the police keep on staying around too long and he gets a headache and finally he can't stand it anymore. You're listening to, and finally... I mean, there's something absolutely horrifically violent about this, which you don't hear in most whitewashed performances.
Mm-hmm. As we hear them now. Peter Schaeffer in Amadeus has this great line about Mozart taking dictation from God. You talk about him shaking music out of his sleeves.
Mm-hmm.
He himself, what was it? There's this famous line where he said that writing, he wrote music like a sow piddled.
Did he say that?
A put up job?
I think so, a little bit, because later on in his life he said, nobody has any idea how hard I work. We had a long time this mythical feeling of Mozart composing an entire piece in his mind and then committing it to paper as if he were actually writing down a poem like one that you and I might memorize. That he was able to do this is beyond question. There is a letter where he says to his father, writing about his great opera Idomeneo, "Well, I've got no little bit to do. Everything is composed, but nothing is written down."
It's all there, just waiting to pluck the apple.
It's inside his head, but we have enough sketches. His widow destroyed about 90% of them, but enough of them to see that music was very hard work for him. That, you know, if he wanted to be the greatest composer who ever lived, he certainly could have written music 100th as good as what he did. He was driven by a compulsion to hold a mirror up to society and show the society in all of its, you know, its weaknesses and strengths.
Let's hear something from Don Giovanni, if we can. Take us forward here. We've got a party scene here. Can you describe it for us?
Yes, well, this is a perfect example of just what I mean. Mozart, after all, is in the middle of the story of the libertine Don Giovanni seducing 1,003 young girls in Spain and more in France and so on and so forth. And yet, even though he's a horrible human being and we should think of him as a villain, when he sings the champagne aria, we all want to go to party with him. Mozart's uncanny ability as a dramatist is to make everything every character as sympathetic as that character is capable of being in front of the audience. So here we have the scene. Don Giovanni's thrown his party. The nobles come, Donna Anna, whom he may or may not have seduced, her boyfriend, Don Ottavio. You know, he's murdered Donna Anna's father.
Yes.
And in the meantime, he's trying to seduce a peasant girl, Celina, and his her fiancé is there, so it's a messy situation, and Mozart's servant, Leporello, is there. So Mozart has this fantastic idea of presenting a picture of society. The upper classes dance the minuet, and Donna Anna and Don Ottavio do that. And that is going to be...
How
and then you have the peasants who are represented here by Mazzetto, the fiancé of Zerlina, and Leporello, who's supposed to distract them by dancing with them, going... And then in the middle, Don Giovanni, who goes slumming and picks Zerlina from the lower classes and meets her in the middle and dances the country dance, which is in the middle.
Sort of middle class making their steps.
Exactly. And so Mozart depicts the society as it was and also the social conflict and tension inherent in this highly volatile situation. And he manages to make these three dances in three different tempos and three different meters all fit together.
Let's listen to the social analyst Mozart. Here, Eberhard Wachter is Don Giovanni with Carlo Maria Giulini conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra and chorus.
Poveretto, il tuo compagno sa, ma se Zerlina,
Zerlina,
c'è pur là. Non ho ballato voglio, però
And on they go. Do you hear it? Help us interpret.
It's, you've got the country dance going on now together with the minuet. And you've got two of the three ingredients. And meanwhile, if you listen carefully, the third orchestra is going to start to tune.
And?
Now, you've got the third orchestra. The three classes of society made sublime forever and a day.
When audiences of Mozart's day sat down for the opera... First of all, who was there? And secondly, what was their response? Did they say, who's the genius, who's the madman, who's the social bomb thrower? How did they respond to Mozart?
Well, they had a very complex response to them. The more, and of course there, Zerlina screams, because Don Giovanni takes her into the anteroom and tries to make good on his seduction, and then things go very, very bad for the main character, as you can hear. Everybody is menacing him, and things that he tries to accuse Leporello of doing the seduction, at which point swords are drawn and things go very, very bad.
We are at the opera.
We are indeed. And this is a story that's centuries old. Mozart's music was understood by the intelligentsia as being something really quite extraordinary, quite uncanny. There was a sense by some people, as I say, that he was going a little bit too far. But you have to understand that music is always a reflection of social codes. You know, that when you hear a minuet, when you hear a march, it immediately symbolized to us pomp,
yes,
you know, a royal procession,
a social
celebration.
Mm-hmm.
If you hear a minuet... Like the one from Don Giovanni, it celebrates a certain elegance, a certain social status. And all of these symbols that a composer throws out like this immediately produce a reaction, just as if Bach, in the depiction of the Last Judgment, suddenly has the trumpet play a hymn in the background in which the words are not sung, but every one of the Protestant congregation knew every word of that, and it struck, you know, ice into their blood because they knew that it meant that the moment of judgment was near.
So music, is Mozart celebrating the status quo? Is he challenging it?
He's doing both. He is. I think the important thing to understand about Mozart, as we see in a scene like this, is that he does not take sides. He does not see it as his responsibility to cast judgment on people. He loves human beings, and he loves making them come to life in front of us. Put another way, he loves to put the mirror to us and say, "There but for the grace of God goest thou," or in fact, "This is in fact who thou art." And he does so, like George Bernard Shaw in Pygmalion that became My Fair Lady.
Right, right. I want to hear more, maybe something from Così Fan Tutti. We've got the quintet number 8 from the first act of Così Fan Tutti. This is the English Baroque soloist under John Eliot Gardner. Set us up here, Robert Levin.
This is the moment. Well, you see, a somewhat cynical philosopher sets up two brothers who are lovers, who are engaged to two sisters, to make a test of their fidelity through a grotesque stratagem in which they'll pretend to be called off to military service. They'll go away, return in disguise, seduce the opposite sister, and see whether they succeed. They bet the philosopher that the sisters will be true. The philosopher bets that they'll capitulate. And the fact of the matter is that they make fools of themselves, the men more than the women, because the men should know better than to try to tempt a fate like this. And this is the moment when the farewell has been set up and the girls sigh and make the men promise to write every day. And as they sigh, the sense of the sublime, the aching beauty of all of this is unbelievable. This passage just melts anybody. Let's turn the music up again, because this is the best moment of all.
Let's hear it.
And as they say goodbye, the philosopher says, I'm breaking apart. I'm just laughing myself to pieces. So there are the two brothers feigning the sorrow of departure, the two women who believe them.
Yes.
And the sense of all, and then people say, oh, this is just a spoof. Mozart is just making fun. You don't make fun and write music that haunts the heart like that. It's about human frailty. That's what it's about. And human frailty is not a comedy. It's a tragedy.
Robert Levin, who did Mozart write for? Did he write for himself? Did he write for his father, his dead mother, a patron, God?
He was a short order cook. He wrote for the public that would pay the bills. And when he got a commission to write an opera, he wrote one. Once in a while, he would start a project in case he got another commission, but he put it aside as soon as someone walked in through the door and said, I need a concerto, I need a quartet, I need an opera, I need a piano sonata.
And
I need
who would
a piano
it be
quartet.
Walking through the door and saying that? Oh, how did he make a living?
Some of his fellow musicians, sometimes publishers, of course, emissaries of the court. Something like the opera had to be commissioned by the court, because that was a lot of money. Mozart could live from an operatic commission for a year or two if he weren't too spendthrift. So you see, in fact, if you look at his music very carefully, pieces that he picked up and then put down for a year and a half and then picked up again when there was a financial basis for his making his money with it. We didn't know things like this 20 or 30 years ago because people hadn't looked at his handwriting, the color of his inks, the watermarks of his paper, all very boring things in themselves, but
they tell a story.
They prove what he actually did.
And when that person walked through the door to order whatever it would be from your short order cook Mozart, who was it that they found? What was the character of this man?
Well, his wife said that although music, of course, was his path, his destiny, and, of course, his mastery, that his real obsession was the dance. He writes a letter to his father saying they had a ball at the house, and all the friends came, and they arrived at 6 and they left at 7. No, Papa, not just for an hour. They left at 7 in the morning. So disco in Vienna of the 1780s was really something that went on.
Was he the giddy man-child of the movie, the stage play Amadeus?
No, he certainly wasn't. That was drawn from a hundredth of his personality. Yes, when writing to his cousin, he wrote scurrilous letters full of vulgarity, but people don't know that Mozart's mother and father also used those terms. Everybody talked about body functions in those days. There was nothing...
Martin Luther, even earlier.
Well, exactly. There was nothing new about that. We're just a bit more prudish about it. When you see next to the letter he's writing to his cousin, a beautiful poetic letter he writes in Italian to Aloysia Weber, in whom he's in love, you get a bit better of a balance between those two things. I think he had to let out some steam once in a while, so he wrote some very filthy canons so that he and his friends could laugh their heads off while then going into the next room and writing a sublime opera.
Yeah, we're having a good time celebrating, looking forward to the anniversary tomorrow of the 250th anniversary of the birth of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. I am at the grand piano side and delighted to be so with Robert Levin, concert pianist, a Mozart scholar, professor of music at Harvard University. We'll go out of this segment on the third movement of Mozart's Symphony No. 40. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are celebrating and exploring the life and world of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart on the eve of the 250th anniversary of his birth with concert pianist and Mozart scholar Robert Levin right next to me at the grand piano keyboard. He's been there at that keyboard and with Mozart for a long, long time, knows it inside and out, and we're delighted to have the advantage of that as we look back on 2.5 centuries now since this birth. We were in the midst of operas there, and I want to stick with that for another minute. We haven't come to the Magic Flute. 1791 he wrote it, the year of his death, at age 35, a short life. Here we've got Cheryl Studer as the evil queen of the night singing this aria in The Magic Flute. Robert Levin, take us in.
She is talking about revenge here. She wants Tamino, the prince, who has fallen in love with her daughter Pamina, to murder Sarastro, who is the high priest at the temple. And of course, this opera is a kind of raggle-taggle thing. It's about masonry, it's about brotherly love, but it's written for the masses. It's written for the greengrocers and the blacksmiths, not just for the aristocracy. Mm. It's a cross-cultural phenomenon, and everybody flocked to Schikaneder's theater, Emanuel Schikaneder, who put this kind of thing together.
And this is in Vienna?
This is in Vienna, in the outskirts of Vienna, this theater. And after a period in which Mozart was in deep financial distress, he writes this piece, and it's a smash hit. Everyone comes. Salieri comes. The emperor comes. Even though, as I said, you've got Papageno the birdcatcher singing this folk-like stuff. And at this moment, you know, the hero has fallen in love with the heroine, and the mother, who sent him to go and capture her back, is afraid that he's going to go off and not, in fact, destroy the temple. So as you can see, she's hopping mad.
She's hopping mad, but it's still so beautiful. There's Cheryl Studer singing, "The vengeance of hell is in my heart." That's a quite lovely vengeance.
Well, it's a very aristocratic vengeance, if you like. But what you see in, of course, all of this is there's a lot of mysticism that runs through it. There is a lot of the Masonic ritual. There are the trials of fire and water that go on at the end of all of this.
Really, and the supernatural coming in here.
The supernatural does come very much into it, and what you see in the magic flute is something which is so really truly extraordinary. That is, you feel this noble rage in this aria that we've just heard, the folksy birdcatcher Papageno talking about going out and catching his birds, and at the other hand, the three boys at the temple who... Something so solemn, so childlike at the same time, so visionary in a certain way. It gives you a sense, a perspective of a kind of a transcendental existence, as Tamino is called on by these boys to be faithful, to you know, to hold up to his integrity, and so on. Or Sarastro, the head of the temple, who sings in these holy halls a piece full of wisdom, you know.
From the Magic Flute, 1791, last year of his life. What was leading him toward death? We've seen headlines about this recently.
Well, it's quite sad in a way, because death was a very, very late visitor to Mozart. You know, things were going rather well in 1791. He was achieving a comeback. His prospects had looked up. People wanted more music from him. And suddenly, you know, suddenly in the autumn, at the height of the success of the Magic Flute, he rushes off to Prague to write an old-fashioned Italian opera for the coronation of the new emperor and Leopold II, which was referred to by one of the princes there as a German swinishness, Mozart's piece, which of course is kind of silly. And he exhausted himself trying to get that done in 3 weeks, rushes back to Vienna. He's working on the clarinet concerto. His wife is off taking the waters in Baden. Yes. And suddenly he becomes sick, and he doesn't quite know why. He thinks he's going to get over it, and it becomes clear then after a little while that he might not get over it. In the meantime, he has received this commission to write a requiem from an industrialist who bought the title of count because he was rich, he had chalk mines, and his wife, who was a young woman, liked music, so did he, and he would commission people to write pieces that he would paste his own name over and pretend to be the composer.
This is Count Walsegg.
This is Count Walsegg, and Count Walsegg would have a quartet done, and he would ask the courtiers, "Now, who wrote that?" And they'd say, "Oh, of course, you, my liege," and he would smile faintly, but of course, all of this was a charade. His wife suddenly died. She was very, very young.
The count's
wife, yes. And Mozart was called upon by Walsegg to write a requiem mass that could be celebrated on the anniversary of her death in perpetuity for the count. And Mozart was paid a certain amount of money to take the commission, and a certain amount of money would be paid once he got it done.
He would never finish it.
He would never finish it. He started to work on it, went off to Prague to write that lickety-split opera, La Clemenza di Tito, came back, and became ill. He was lying in bed, and he would look at his watch, and he would know at what time each aria was being done. Now, the Sanctus, which we hear in the background, is a piece that has no provable connection with Mozart. His assistant, Süssmayr, had to finish the piece so that poor Constanze could get the rest of the money to feed her two hungry little boys. And this is a crapshoot, what you're hearing below here. It is what Süssmayr composed, edited by yours truly, and this is an attempt to put the requiem into a more complete condition, which is how it was delivered in 1792. Let's have a listen to the fugue, which is only about a minute and a half long.
Thank you.
Mozart's Requiem, as edited by my guest, Robert Levin, for the wife, the dead wife of Count Walsegg. Could it have served as his own? What was Mozart's relationship with religion?
Mozart certainly became aware of the fact that the Requiem was likely to become his own at the very end. Süssmayr, the assistant, came up to him, and Mozart presumably gave him some verbal instructions about what to do, because Mozart became aware of the fact that he was leaving a wife and two young children in a state of considerable precariousness. Mozart grew up in the archiepiscopal court town of Salzburg, where his primary employer was the Prince Archbishop, and he wrote lots and lots of sacred music, 15 masses, a large number of other sacred pieces. He was brought up very much in the Catholic tradition, and he speaks about his obligations to God very often in a tone that makes one wonder when he talks to his father that he's telling his father what he thinks his father wants to hear. But when he discovers that his father is gravely ill in 1787, the year of Don Giovanni, he writes a remarkable letter to him, first of all saying that he had no idea that how ill that he really was, and he was becoming very, very alarmed. But he said that in most recent times he had come to know and to love this best and truest friend of man, namely death. One has to remember that children were often, you'd have to have four or five of them before one would survive.
Because
they died
lost
in childbirth all
again,
of the time.
And again and again. Yes.
People were very, very stoical about that. Mozart had seven children, only two of them survived.
Yes.
And he was not the first.
All by the same wife, just one wife.
Yes, by Constanze. So Mozart, for instance, wrote the C minor mass, which was also like the Requiem unfinished, as a vow for the recovery of his wife, who was ill before they got married, and also in hopes of reconciling his father, who was against the marriage. So we see the sense of belief in God as a way of transcending everything. Also, a very personal kind of meaning to the text. After all, when Mozart wrote the Et Incarnatus Est from the C minor Mass, you know the... A piece radiant with love and devotion.
Yes.
There is his little child, his little son, his firstborn, playing in his crib. And here is this text that says, was made flesh, you know, through the Virgin Mary of the Holy Ghost, and was made man. Now, there is Mozart beholding the miracle of his firstborn. There is the miracle of the infant Jesus. One could forgive Mozart for seeing in his son the very kind of essence of all of this, and for the faith in God to animate his music and his life. So his masonry was a social thing. A generation later, Beethoven fights for liberty, uses French revolutionary hymns in his symphonies, which could have gotten him sent to jail if the people were smart enough to know what they were. Beethoven writing Fidelio, you know, against tyranny. Beethoven, a political activist. Mozart, not a political activist, but someone who saw spirituality and human dignity as very, very important characters, qualities. He identified, to be sure, with the aristocratic class. He wore expensive clothes.
They
he traveled a lot. They did pay his bills, not enough of his bills, but they certainly paid more of them than certain of his competitors, and fewer than Beethoven's, who lived under stipends and had a more stable life financially, although certainly a more disorderly life privately.
Robert Levin, we have only 5 minutes left. I want your fingers on that keyboard just as much as we can get them there. And as you play for us, I guess the questions that remain are this. I was reading recently the mathematician Mark Katz describing Richard Feynman, the visionary physicist.
Yes, absolutely.
He said there are two types of geniuses, the ordinary kind and then what he called the magicians. Those really beyond our grasp, a genius beyond what we can imagine ourselves in supercharged form. Was Mozart of that latter? And what is that quality of genius that goes really into the realm of magic?
I think, well, there's a kind of sublime magic, which is when you hear a tune like this one. Thank you. so natural, so flowing, so generous, so warm-hearted, you know, a melody of love that seems to express more articulately, more poignantly a feeling of affection towards another human being than we ourselves could do. But there is also the vision into hell, into psychotic nightmares also, which can come up in Mozart in just, you know, the snap of the fingers. We heard a bit of the 40th Symphony. In the 39th Symphony, he starts the second movement in a very charming way. And then later on, it becomes... And suddenly... Everything comes unstuck. You think, my God, just what's going on? This is horrific. What's going on? And suddenly... And the storm is gone and everything is as it was before, except that night you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you remember the moment when he saw the darker side of human existence.
The door of hell opening right there.
Absolutely.
And then there's this. Put on Mozart anywhere in the world and people will gather around and listen and relate, maybe more than any other musician I know. I don't know what your experience is. There's something absolutely universal, regardless of class or caste or creed or, you know, part of the world. What is that?
I think we come back to the simplicity of the child, the wisdom of the philosopher, extraordinary intelligence at using means both simple and complex to weave a tapestry of human existence in its glory and in its disgrace, in its madness and in its joys, in its voluptuousness and in its ugliness, and all, as I say, without passing judgment, all allowing us, in effect, as spectators, to have the last word. Spectators who, of course, in the end, are much more than that. We are, in fact, the actors, and we do understand that in the end, every musical word that Mozart ever uttered is always about us.
This is theater of life. He was in it. We're in it. He keeps us right there.
That's exactly right.
And wow, the roof of heaven is lofty there.
It is.
Robert Levin, it's been just fabulous sitting by this beautiful, great piano with you, taking this tour. You're very good to do it on the eve of Mozart's 250th, the anniversary of the 250th birthday of Mozart. We could not be more grateful to you.
I couldn't be more grateful to be here to share this with you.
It's just fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
We'll go out with the first movement from Mozart's Symphony No. 41, also known as the Jupiter Symphony. Here, Claudio Abbado conducts the London Symphony Orchestra. Special thanks this hour to Antonio Oliart. Happy birthday, Mozart 250. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.